Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, April 8th, 2019, and I'm Kara Santamaria. I want to thank those of you who supported the show this week by going to patreon.com/talknerdy and pledging your support. The top patrons this week are Timothy Glover, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Phil T-Bear, the zombie drummer, David J. E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you all so, so very much. All right, guys, I'm really excited about this week's show because I had a chance to chat with an incredible woman. She's a medical writer, a lecturer at Yale University, a writer in residence at Yale Medical School, and an adjunct professor at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Her name is Dr. Randi Hutter Epstein, and her new book is Aroused: The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything. Yes, indeed, they do. This is a fascinating chat, and I don't want to keep you guys from it. So without any further ado, here she is, Randi Hutter Epstein. Well, Randi, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here. I'm aroused to be here, actually.
Well, that is so perfect, because, of course, we're talking about your new book, Aroused: The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything. You know what's funny is I was talking to one of my supervisors just yesterday, and she was saying that she was struggling once when she was trying to counsel a friend. She's a psychologist, but she wasn't talking to a patient. She was just trying to counsel a friend who was dealing with postpartum. Mm-hmm. And she thought that trying to tell her, yeah, obviously, you know, there's a lot going on in your mind and you're dealing with these feelings of distress and these feelings of guilt. But honestly, your body is just like crazy with hormones right now. And you've got to listen to yourself and understand that it's really hard to control those kinds of things. But then she felt like maybe I'm discounting, you know, and I'm discounting her actual lived experience by sort of just blaming everything on her hormones. Is that like a difficulty that you find, this difference between like how much do the hormones really control and how much can you overcome with your mind?
Oh, it's so interesting, because I was having a talk with my daughter, who's 22, about that today. And without talking about what she was going through, and not postpartum at all, but we got talking about this because, you know, we think hormonal. And I think I'm sure your friend was thinking, oh, no, I hope the woman I'm talking to, my friend, is not thinking I'm dismissing her complaints by just saying, yeah, you're hormonal, you just gave birth.
Or like, that's like such a sexist thing too, right? Because women, only women ever get hormonal.
Exactly. And you know, your spouse is, and your son is, and your dog is, everyone's hormonal. But on the other hand, you don't want to be dismissed as, oh, it's hormonal, as if, oh, it's just your woman body acting out and rise above it.
Yeah.
But what we do have to try to appreciate and really have compassion for ourselves is, yeah, these hormones do control a lot. And so, yes, after you give birth, there's a dramatic change in hormones that go on as the baby comes out and as your body doesn't need, you know, as much of this high level of progesterone to keep the lining thick so that the baby can grow. And a lot of times we, women, men, you know, we feel not so much the exact level of the hormone, but we feel the changes. So if you were high in estrogen and then went low, or if you were low and then went high, we feel these changes, like these tidal waves. So yeah, I think it's right to say we go through these hormonal times, and these hormonal periods definitely affect our moods and our hunger and all sorts of things. But it's a funny question in terms of like, can we rise above it? Because hormones are us, you know, they're our body chemistry. So it's really hard to distinguish what's us. They are us, you know, and are we rising above ourselves? I think there are times maybe certain women might feel during their menstrual cycle that they're craving more sugar or they're getting hungrier. And rather than just say, gosh, I have no willpower right now, you can say, you know what? I know it's my hormones. And then you can decide, you know what? I know this happens a couple days every month. And you know what? I am. I'm just going to let myself give in to this drive to eat more, whether it's have more sugar. And I'll know that I'm going to feel a little awful after, but I'm just going to like sit with it and know that in a few days I'll feel better. Or maybe you'll say, oh, I'm just going to really try hard not to give in to those urges this month because I know it's just going to spiral and then make me feel worse. So I think it's this give and take, and it's having a little more compassion with ourselves. So in the postpartum case, rather than, which I think a lot of women do, rather than think, oh, this is hormonal, we start thinking, what is it about me? What is going on in my mind that I cannot handle this? So rather than think, oh, hormones, we're thinking like, what did I do wrong? You know, shouldn't I be happier now that I just had a baby? Shouldn't I have this rush of energy? And you start to like psychoanalyze yourself and think, oh, wait, maybe it's because of this. Maybe I did this wrong. Maybe I'm not loving enough. So I think sometimes when we say, oh, no, actually, my hormones just went through this dramatic change, then it allows us to have more self-compassion.
I think it's interesting that you made the point, the comment, that it's not the highs, it's not the lows, it's the scoops, it's the changes in these hormonal levels that we notice the most, that we have the most kind of subjective experience for, mm-hmm. because obviously that aligns, you know, it's the plural of anecdote is not data, but that aligns with my experience for sure. And probably many women who are like, oh yeah, like once a month, right before I get my period, I might feel a little more sad or a little more like uncontained. Maybe it's a little harder for me to keep my emotions from being revealed on my face, for example. But then the whole week that I'm on my period, I feel normal again.
Exactly. Exactly. It's that pre-time when there's, you know, if you look in some of your middle school biology books, and they always showed those sort of like waves of your hormones during the menstrual cycle. Mm-hmm. It's really in terms of that high to low, you know, those dramatic changes when your pituitary gland sends out signals to make, oh, okay, now we, you know, we're going to have a rush of estrogen come out and then a rush of progesterone. And that's when you feel it. And we know that, you know, for instance, there are women that are very low estrogen. Sometimes that happens, like anorexic women who are keeping their, you know, or starving themselves, and it lowers your estrogen. It screws up a lot with your appetite hormones too. Mm-hmm. And so they don't feel like their low estrogen isn't the same as when someone who's cycling goes from high to low.
Yeah.
So it's really the difference of the dramatic changes in estrogen and other hormones as well. We feel the changes, not so much the actual level.
And that's even the case for many of us, myself included, who have been on like birth control our entire lives, right? Because in a way, even though there's a sort of, I don't want to say artificiality to it, but there's a pharmacologically induced change in those estrogen and progesterone levels based on the hormones that we're either taking orally or in my case, using like the NuvaRing, you take it out once a month. And when you take it out, your hormones like dramatically change.
Absolutely. And it's even, you know, someone I know just told me that they were having, or their child was having, major PMS, which they didn't realize was PMS at first. And they're like, oh, these horrible mood swings hit her once a month. They can almost predict them. And she's trying the birth control pill in some ways to level out. So maybe going on this pharmacological menstrual cycle will make the highs and lows not as high and low as it was for her naturally.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah, I think it's funny. I try to think back. I'm 35 now. I started taking birth control when I was 16. But I did start taking birth control before I was having sex because my periods were so painful and were so intense that my gynecologist at the time recommended, hey, sometimes utilizing birth control can help level those kinds of things out. And that intensity, the pain, the nausea, you know, the real somatic complaints, not just the emotional complaints, are also all tied up in our hormones, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's all tied up in the hormones. And, you know, and the other thing that I think women should understand, the women that are on birth control, is that we tend to think PMS, that you're going to have these symptoms right before you menstruate. Some women that go on like different forms of birth control, like the IUD, mm-hmm. they don't menstruate as frequently, the way the hormones are given out in the IUD. Even if you're not bleeding, you can still have the same PMS mm-hmm. because your body is going through those hormone fluctuations. You may not bleed, you may not menstruate, and you're thinking, God, why do I feel so lousy? I feel like I'm going to get my period, but then I didn't, because your body still had that those hormonal changes, some of them.
Oh, that's fascinating. And of course, pregnancy is a whole other complicated mess of hormones that, as I guess I remember taking an endocrinology class when I was getting my master's degree and learning about all the different hormones and all the different like neuropeptides and, you know, certain things that are made in your brain by your pituitary and then other things that are made locally by these endocrine glands. And they all mix together in this slow kind of leaky mix that really do affect mm-hmm. every aspect of your life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And pregnancy as well. And, you know, for some women, I mean, I tended to have easy pregnancies, which would probably make me a less sympathetic OBGYN if I were one. My OBGYN felt awful during her pregnancy, so she was probably more sympathetic to the way people felt. But yeah, pregnancy adds that whole other issue of, you know, more progesterone, your breasts feel swollen. There are some women that just feel a little emotionally different. I think for some women, though, also, you feel different, but it's not, you're not having those swings that you do in your menstrual cycle. So some women actually feel better during pregnancy, not menstruating, not having like highs and lows as much.
And some say it's during the second trimester that they really start to feel well, right? Like that's what I've heard from a lot of my friends that were like, pretty sick or pretty uncomfortable in their first trimester. And then like almost like clockwork, when they kind of hit around their second trimester, they started to feel really well. And I'm wondering, is that because there's an expectation of that? Was that a placebo situation or is something happening with their hormones that's very different as the pregnancy advances?
You know, it's really funny. There's so much that we still don't understand about pregnancy and hormones. I mean, there's a lot that we do understand, but there's so much that we don't. And I'm going to blame this on a lack of really good women's research. I think that if men went through pregnancy and menopause and had PMS, oh, we'd understand everything really, really well. And we would have cures. Like PMS would not exist, either with any menopausal symptoms if men went through
it. Oh, for sure.
They would just make sure that it was targeted research and we would have great, you know, great ways to deal with side effects.
They'd be like over the counter by now, for sure.
Oh, over the counter. They would be giving it out. Like it would be part, you'd come to school and it would be part of homework.
Yeah.
But that said, so in pregnancy, we really don't understand. I mean, you can read, oh, it's the progesterone. Oh, it's this that makes you feel nauseated. It probably does have to do with progesterone, but we kind of don't understand morning sickness. Some women have it, some don't. Again, I think that it goes back to also the change. Like your body's not used to having that much progesterone and other things that we may not even realize that go on during these early stages of pregnancy. You know, we're learning now that your microbiome, all those germs that line your gut that everyone's talking about, they secrete hormones, your hormones affect them. So I wouldn't be surprised if we found out that the way our bodies change in the beginning of pregnancy and the hormones that we're spewing and that this little embryo is starting to spew affects the microbiome, affects the gut germs.
Yeah.
And that then will affect levels of nausea. Why does it then fade? I think your body is always looking for balance. It's sort of the way nature's made us, we're kind of looking for that balance. So I think for some women, not all, for some women, yeah, you do feel better after the first few months. I mean, I only had real morning sickness for my fourth child. And then it did fade. But I do have to say, I have never experienced, I've had three pregnancies, four kids, because there's twins in the middle. There's this like old wives thing of like, oh, then you're going to get a burst of energy.
Yeah.
I really think that like when sperm meets egg and it starts to multiply in you, that's exhausting. And then now that my kids are grown, I can tell you that you stay exhausted at least for the next 25 years of your life, quarter century. Because my son's 25. So I don't know, maybe it's like going to last forever, forever and ever and ever. But the nausea has gone away. The nausea has gone away. My youngest is 18 years old. The nausea has definitely subsided. Like, I'm still really tired and stay up too late and I have no control over them. So.
Oh my God, I love it so much. You know, I feel like your books, obviously, just having the opportunity to chat with you today, I hear you in your books. Sometimes that's not the case when I talk to authors. Sometimes their writing style and their conversational style are really different, but I hear you through the pages of your book. And I have to say, one of the things that I love is that, yes, you are a physician. Yes, you are a science writer. Yes, you have like all of these incredible accolades, which we will get to because I'm fascinated by, you know, your journey. And I want to talk about that. But you also have actual academic training and a rich understanding of the history of science. And that's something that I think is so great about this book, is that you tell the story of hormones with a real nod to the history of discovery in like a really funny way. So I thought maybe we could take a step back, because we came out the gate almost talking about hormones the way that, you know, that landmark Supreme Court case talked about pornography. Like, I don't know what they are, but like, I know it when I see it, right? Like, I don't really know how to define it, but I know it when I see it. Like, everybody knows what hormones are, but we do know what hormones are from a scientific perspective. We haven't really had a chance to dive into that. So I thought maybe you could take us back and walk us through what is a hormone, where are hormones made, you know, generally speaking, what can they do, and how do we learn all this stuff?
Sure. So first of all, yeah, I love this question, because people think like hormone is like this just vague notion of kind of stuff going on in your body, but it's actually a specific definition. Mm-hmm. And the definition of a hormone is a chemical secreted by a gland that hits a faraway target. So what we mean by that isn't far away, like New York to California, but far away from like brain to ovary or brain to testy. And nowadays, when you think like, oh, well, no big deal. Like, you know, we secrete something and it goes to a target. It actually was a big deal when we first discovered hormones. So like, I like to think of your hormones as your internal Wi-Fi, in the sense that, well, I actually know nothing about Wi-Fi. I love this metaphor because like, I can't even turn my television on. I actually can't. Because it's not just an on off button now, apparently like there's like on watch cable, anyhow, but I think it's through Wi-Fi. But what I do know about Wi-Fi is when I sit at my computer and I want to send an email to someone, I am hoping that my email goes to that person and not just a million people along the way, wherever it floats through cyberspace. Mm-hmm. That's the way your hormones work. Your insulin goes up, you know, when you've eaten, and you want it to go directly to those molecules to like to ferry the glucose out of your blood and where the glucose is needed. We need it to be that specific. When we first, not we, you and I didn't do this, but two British scientists, when these two British scientists came up with this theory about hormones, it was really controversial and really kind of thought crazy, because we didn't have a system, we didn't have Wi-Fi, it was 1905, we weren't thinking cell receptors. And the thinking was that everything in the body marched along nerves, you know, that, and that's how messages went.
Gotcha. So nutrients were in the blood and information was only in the nerve cells.
Exactly. And it marched along like train tracks, you know, it was just connected. And sure, like oxygen, you know, goes down the blood, but that you can think of like as a raft going down a river and it just knocks about. It's used wherever it's needed. Yeah. So the thought that these chemicals would flow through the blood, but reach a target and a specific target was actually unbelievable. Like some people did not believe it when the notion first came out, but they were right. And that's how hormones work. And so if we take a step back, it is kind of pretty cool that we have this system in our body. It's fascinating. It means that if you're a diabetic and you have to take insulin, you don't have to get the insulin right into your pancreas and then the pancreas will send it out. You can inject insulin anywhere you want in the body. And your body will know where, you know, where the target is, how to get it to where it's needed.
And so when you think of a hormone, you think of this like molecule, right? This actual physical measurable, you know, molecule, maybe a peptide or, you know, some sort of, what are they usually? Are they peptides?
They're different. Okay. Like we know that some are chains of amino acids, some are loopy. I mean, they're not one tiny, they are teeny tiny, but they're not usually one molecule, but some are like loops and chains of amino acids, like your steroid molecules, and some are tiny little proteins. So they're sort of chains of molecules, but they tend to be uber potent and they come in really tiny packets. So, and I think that's the other reason why I've been fascinated with hormones. It's just amazing to have something so tiny pack such a powerful punch. So when we think, oh, we have too much of this hormone or not enough of that, the ups and downs are like in nanograms. They're like teeny, tiny little ups and downs. When someone gives you hormones, they're not giving you a quarter cup of it. They're giving you a like teardrop of, you know, even less than that, a pinpoint, and it has this powerful ramification.
Wow. And so, you know, when I think of kind of the differentiation, the main difference between neurotransmitters, which I'm much more comfortable with, because I took lots of classes about neurotransmitters and only one class about hormones. When I think about neurotransmitters, these are molecules that are released by one nerve cell, whether it's in the brain or, you know, the spinal cord or even in the periphery. And they jump across the tiniest little synapse to the next cell. And that's about it. And then sometimes they're taken back up by the previous cell, but it's like local, like right from here to here. But with the hormones, you're saying that the brain can release something and your toes can receive it. Like it literally can flow through your whole body and hit targets like really far away.
Yeah. And it's actually, now that we're learning more about hormones and more about neurotransmitters, there's not really a very sharp distinction. So there are some neurotransmitters that were like, oh, like dopamine, is that a hormone? Is that a neurotransmitter? And I don't like to try to, I mean, to me, it's kind of semantics.
Yeah.
But, you know, we think of hormones as traveling far and neurotransmitters close. And then where do you put the line? Where do you say like, okay, sorry, you've just hit the state border, you know, and now you're a hormone.
Yeah, especially when we talk about like serotonin being in the gut and like, yeah, you're right. It's like we're just constantly breaking the rules and finding new examples that don't fit the taxonomic mold that we first came up with.
Exactly. And there's a whole field of neuroendocrinology and neuropsychoendocrinology. And I have a hunch those people aren't sitting around going, is it a hormone? Is it a neurotransmitter? I think we like to think of them all as chemical messengers in the body. And we're probably learning that some hormones work locally and don't travel that far. Mm-hmm. And some neurotransmitters, I'm actually not sure some go that far. They do jump across these tiny little synapses, but I think it's a blur, and we are learning more and more how that the brain is flooded with these hormone receptors. So that's why, you know, there's progesterone receptors and estrogen receptors in the brain. So we're learning more and more about these brain-body interactions.
And hormones, of course, you know, we keep mentioning like the pituitary gland, or we haven't mentioned the hypothalamus. I'm thinking of the pituitary. I wanted to call it the hypophysis. Oh my God. That's an old school way to talk about it. But, you know, we keep mentioning the brain-producing hormones, but of course, there are hormones that are produced from glands throughout the body as well.
Absolutely. And one of the most exciting things I found working on the book is that now we know the fat cell is an endocrine gland. Mm. You know, it's funny because years ago, like in the early 1900s, the very first hormone researchers, they said, okay, we know there are these glands in the body from doing autopsies, from looking at dead people. Like they could see your thyroid gland, your ovary, your testy, your pituitary gland is right. Like if you took your finger and like put it in between your eyes, and then if you could just shove it right back into your brain, you'd hit your pituitary. Don't do that. I don't want your listeners trying that at home. So they could see these glands. But some of these people in the early 1900s thought maybe everything in the body spews hormones. Mm. Maybe the skin does. Maybe every cell. And we're learning that they weren't that far off. I mean, the fat cell, which was thought of, at least I thought of it too, it's just like a little blob of butter, you know, floating around your body that just made you fat. We're now learning that the fat cell does release signals, and that could affect your appetite, and that could affect other hormone levels and insulin levels. Mm. So we're learning more and more that there are your major glands in the body, the ones we think about. Yes, the hypothalamus tells the pituitary what to do, and the pituitary, and these are in your brain. And then you have your thyroid in your neck that controls your metabolism, and your pancreas that releases insulin, your sugar, that helps you metabolize sugar. So there's all these glands in the body, but we're learning, you know, that there's other cells also that interact too.
Fascinating. And of course, it makes sense when you start to think about the way that these signals communicate and the way that your body needs to know, feedback, right? So like it needs to get back to your brain, back to your body at some point to know whether or not you're producing enough of these things or you're not producing enough of these things. And you know, in hindsight, yeah, obviously your fat cells are going to release signals to tell your body, hey, I'm fat enough now. I don't need much more fuel. This is how we can start to regulate our appetite and things like that. But of course, that must have been absolutely astounding to first discover that, like you said, a vacuole, basically a globule of just like storage, is like talking to other organs in your body.
And we didn't know that till the 1990s. So we're not speaking ancient history.
That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. And of course, you know, I think having this basic understanding of how hormones works is important to understand all these more systems level things that we've been talking about, like our periods, like pregnancy, and we'll get into a few more of those. But I guess the one remaining question about this sort of basic system that might be on some people's minds right now is like, how do these signals, these little peptides, these actual chemical messengers get, and not all peptides, let's just say small molecules, get from the brain to the adrenals, for example, or from the adrenals to some sort of target in your heart or in your digestive tract? Are they going through blood? Are they going through lymph? Are they literally just like floating around in like a bag of fluid? How does that work?
They travel through blood. So that's why I was talking about like oxygen travels through blood, but is just used wherever. But they do travel through blood. But they don't just stop off anywhere. They know where their destination is. Mm-hmm. So that's how they get around. And as you pointed out before, people suspected this earlier, our bodies are constantly surveilling. Like there's a surveillance system so that, oh, estrogen is too high, we need to lower it. This is too low, we need to raise it. So we can think about that in terms of your menstrual cycle. We can think about it even in terms of dieting. We have these hunger hormones. And if you really try to limit your food intake, you know, if you're trying to lose some pounds, that sends a signal to your body, oh no, you're hungry, you need food. So you're fighting against that hormone that wants you to give that urge to eat. Because unfortunately, our bodies were made, I guess fortunately, our bodies were made for survival. That's a good thing. But our bodies were not made to make sure that we have that thin physique that we might really crave. So you might be thinking, I really want those flat abs and get into a bikini. But your body's thinking, let's stay alive, let's be nourished. So as you're trying to minimize your food intake, you're not just changing your sugar levels and your insulin. You're also sending signals to your body that says like, oh my God, you need food. We don't want you to wither away to nothing. We want you to feel nourished and full and healthy.
How funny.
So that's why some people dieting have trouble sticking to it. That's why some people, if you really think, okay, I'm just going to starve myself for these 4 days, you know, you might lose weight or water weight or something in those 4 days. And then by day five, you're just like, okay, now I'm famished. I am so hungry. And you have to try not to eat your 4 days worth of food.
You know, it's funny. I use this app called Noom because lately I've been counting calories. You know, you've seen probably some of the research that came out recently that like the number one predictor of weight loss is just being accountable to the calories that you consume. And, you know, this app was like developed by psychologists and they try to work in. It's mostly like pop psychology because it's obviously for the every consumer. But lately they've been talking a hell of a lot about leptin and ghrelin.
Exactly. And we know the leptin is your I feel full hormone.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's interesting because during the research of my book, I spent a few days with this woman and her son. Her son has a very rare defect. There are people with a rare defect who do not make enough leptin, and that means they are famished all the time.
Oh my gosh, how difficult.
And it's not just the thing about most of these people, not this boy, I'll get to him in a second. The thing about people who don't produce leptin, mm-hmm. is you're not enjoying this food and feeling like, oh my God, let's go out for a wonderful meal. You're obsessed. You're obsessed with food. You're thinking about food. So it's not just a metabolism kind of thing. It's this urge to eat. And of course you're getting obese and you cannot, and it's very unhealthy. What fortunately, once we found out about this and once we've been able to isolate leptin, for most people that have this issue, they can take leptin shots and it balances out their body and it does the trick and they can lead normal lives. And
that must be life-changing when they first experience a satiety signal.
Actually, it's hugely life-changing. And one young man said that he enjoyed food for the first time in his life because you weren't enjoying it. You just had this need. This young boy who I spend time with, unfortunately, his body has a faulty receptor to leptin. So that means just when I was talking about, you know, every hormone knows its target.
Yeah.
Because his body can't use leptin, even if he got those leptin shots, like all the leptin in the world would not help this kid feel full. There are some drugs in the pipeline. They're not available yet. He's too young to be on the trials. His mother just said she cannot wait till he's older and she wants him in a trial, or that maybe the drug will be approved. It's in the pipelines now being tested. But what you see in this child isn't just a kid that is fat and wants to eat all the time, but his thinking is constantly on what's my next meal, what's my next thing that I can eat. And you realize that these hormones don't just control hunger, but this drive to eat. You know, there's a subtle difference. So I intentionally put this obesity chapter at the end of my book because I think this is really cutting edge endocrinology now, because it's not just looking at hunger hormones, but how hormones control our urges. So it's a fascinating thing. And now That said, I talk a lot about in the book the difference between some of the wacky stuff out there and the real stuff. And, you know, ever since we named hormones hormones, there have been people trying to make a buck off of wacky cures then as now.
Yeah.
So you can probably Google, don't do it now. Just keep listening to us, please. Not to be done now. You can Google like a leptin diet. And, you know, there's like, you could supposedly, it makes it sound like, oh, if any of us just gave ourselves a little extra leptin, that would control your appetite. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way.
So you're saying we can't just eat leptin? It doesn't work that way?
And then you'd feel full, because going back to what I said before, how our bodies were made to survive, hunger is the thing that keeps us alive. You know, we need to eat. We need nutrients. So let's just say we gave ourselves a little more leptin to fool the body. Like, oh, you're full, you're full. Well, somehow the body, because there's other hormones and there's other neurotransmitters, would know, don't fool me. You're not getting enough nutrients. I'm going to make you hungry using another route. So,
oh, yeah. We've got a lot of redundant systems, right? That's why I'm always really wary of the pseudoscience in like people who want to hack their body. There's always this, and I don't mean biohacking, like doing weird stuff, like putting magnets under your skin, which is a whole other thing. But I more mean people who are like, oh, eat this way, or only eat one meal a day, or if I go paleo, or if I blah, 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 like I'm hacking my body and convincing it that X, Y, Z. It's like, no, your body's smart and has like a ton of redundant systems. And it's going to like, it's going to regulate and normalize, which is partially why, you know, we were talking before about diets, why really a diet shouldn't be a thing. It should just be your diet, like the way you always eat. Because if you go on a diet, your body will figure out how to start to normalize and regulate around that. It's just what it does.
Absolutely, because your body wants you to stay alive. And so, right, so if you're not eating and you think, oh, I'm going to have like maybe these leptin shots will make me feel full, something, I'll be like, no, you still need to eat. We're going to make you hungry anyhow.
Yeah, and it, from a psychological standpoint, it's actually a fascinating and really, I think, difficult reason why eating disorders can be very difficult to treat. Because unlike substance abuse disorders, you know, we think about the idea, and there's more and more research to show that abstinence for a lot of people is not always the answer. But at least if you chose abstinence, let's say that you have a problem with opiates, you can just stay away from opiates. But if you have a problem with food, sorry, you have to eat. And so it's really hard to regulate that thing. You can't just avoid it.
Well, we're not good at moderation. We can probably all agree on that. You know, that's why some people are like, okay, I'm never going to have sugar. I'm never going to have alcohol. I'm never going to have this. In some ways, that's easier than saying, I'm going to just be moderate. I'm going to have, you know, I'm just going to try to do this moderation thing. We're not good at that. And yes, it's, and the other thing that we're learning about anorexia is getting back to leptin, your leptin levels are really low. And so your body is screaming for hunger. You somehow learn or you train your body not to respond to those hunger signals.
Yeah.
But we now know that the reason why these anorexic women stop menstruating and there's other things that go on in their body. Sometimes they get really hairy arms. Sometimes, you know, it's bone loss. It's because it's a, we think the leptin might be actually what's screwing things up, not just low estrogen and not just insulin, that the leptin is actually sending signals to the body that's screwing things up, that the body's in stress.
Because it's just this chronic production of it. You know, it reminds me a lot of some of the things that I remember early on learning about hormones when I read Robert Sapolsky's famous book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. Like the classical example there was cortisol, this stress hormone, and all the horrible things that happen when you overproduce cortisol for a long time. Because, of course, zebras in the wild are only stressed while they're being chased. But we stress about life and death things, things that up all of these stress hormones in a chronic way.
Right. And that goes against how we're supposed to have this ebb and flow of everything. Mm-hmm. So yes, like a little bit of that stress might be good to help you focus if you have to take a test and then it goes to the next level and your mind goes blank, or you're chronically stressed and we think it affects like your rates of heart disease. So it's again, it goes back, it all goes back to that same thing. Like the menstrual cycle is waves of up and down, same as leptin and ghrelin, same as your stress hormone. We do need it. You can't be completely stress free, but we need it in this nice sort of wave, low wave like kind of thing.
All right, everyone, I want to take a quick break from the show to thank the sponsors of this week's episode, starting with Calm. Now, I've been talking about Calm for quite a while. This is one of those perfect integrations on my show because I actually do use Calm every day and have for a long time, since before we ever partnered to support Talk Nerdy. Calm is the number one app to help you reduce your anxiety and your stress, to help you sleep better, and, you know, to actually be, I think, a really good introduction to mindfulness and meditation, especially if you're not, you know, you're not too excited about the concept, but you feel like it's something you want to be doing. Maybe you're a little bit afraid to get a little introspective, not really sure what's going to come up for you. Calm is a really, really great way to kind of start off easy and work your way up. There are 40 million people around the world that have downloaded it. Can you believe that? And right now you're going to be able to get 25% off of your Calm Premium subscription. So if you go to calm.com, you're going to discover all sorts of really cool stuff. You're going to discover guided meditations. You're going to discover meditations that have less guidance. You're also going to discover music. That's one of my favorite parts, even though I do meditate every night. There's focus music to help you maybe while you're reading or writing. There's relaxation music. There's nature music. And I love the sleep music. Right now, there's actually a really cool ambient kind of album on there by Moby, and it helps me sleep pretty much every single night, especially when I'm traveling. There are also bedtime stories for adults, which I know you're going to love, but you got to try it out because it's hard for me to really express to you how much Calm has been a change in my life. I think you have to experience it for yourself. So go to calm.com/nerdy and you'll get 25% off a Calm Premium subscription. So it's got all those things that I told you about and more. Again, that's calm.com/nerdy for unlimited access to all of Calm's content today. One more time, that's calm.com/nerdy. And as you've been hearing for the past several weeks, I also want to thank Mova for their support of the show. Mova is amazing because Mova makes these stunning, really kind of scientifically interesting globes that are, oh my gosh, I don't know how to explain them except to say that they are such a conversation starter. So they rotate on their own. They're powered by light and they're sort of inside of this cool liquid matrix. So they're really shiny. And when they're exposed to ambient light, like they don't have to be in direct sunlight, literally just in a room, like in your office, they will slowly rotate. No batteries, no plugs. They're going to last forever. And they're really amazing. And we're not just talking like traditional Earth globes, even though they have several different versions of the Earth globe and they're all really beautiful. There are also famous artworks. And my favorite that I tell you every week about are the space collection that feature graphics that are provided directly from NASA and JPL. So they're, you know, high res, fully accurate representations of Jupiter and Saturn and Mercury and Pluto and even things like Titan, right, which is one of Saturn's moons, or Vesta, the asteroid. And they're like completely accurate, absolutely beautiful. And I don't know, like, I think one of the coolest, geekiest things that you can own. And by the way, they make incredible, incredible gifts. So I think you should go check them out right now. And while you're doing it, you're going to be so inspired that I know you're going to want to get one for yourself, maybe even one for a friend. So the good news is I've got a coupon code for you for 10% off your purchase. Go to www.movaglobes.com/nerdy and use the coupon code nerdy. So again, that's www.movaglobes.com/nerdy for 10% off. All right, guys, let's get back to the show.
So speaking of those waves and that kind of ebb and flow, you know, the conventional wisdom that I was always under the impression of was that, like, women have monthly cycles, but men have daily cycles of hormones. And of course, I don't think it's that simple because women also cycle daily and monthly. Men, of course, don't have menstrual cycles, though, but they have changes in their androgen levels over the course of a day, don't they? So how come women are hormonal and moody or hysterical, or let's think of all the other horribly sexist words that actual medical professionals have used historically. But men, what, they're just aggressive? They just have, you know, anger? They're cycling all the time, aren't they?
They are, but not in the dramatic plummet that we do. So I'm not sympathetic to this male menopause kind of thing. Like, men their testosterone does start to drip lower and lower, starting at like mid to late 30s. It gets less and less. Some men really feel it. They might have problems with erection. They might, you know, if your testosterone plummets, you might, you know, you'll have low libido, you'll feel more tired. But it's not as dramatic as women. So we go through this dramatic menopause. We have a reason to feel the way we do. The men, it's not quite as dramatic. So they don't have those same hormonal flows, you know, but a lot of this stuff, yes, we do think testosterone, which women have also, is tied to libido. But some of the other things are a little, one of my friends who's writing about testosterone, Katrina Karkazis, she calls it the aspirational hormone, testosterone, because she thinks we put a lot of things on it and it's gone through history. Like, oh, if men have more testosterone than women, then it must be the confidence hormone. It must make you think more clearly. Some of this is not so much proof from scientific research, but just the way we've traditionally thought what men are and what women are.
Yeah, that testosterone as a hormone is responsible for masculinity.
Exactly. And then what we've always thought masculinity is. So one of the fun stories I have in my book, and it goes back to the 1920s, and I won't get into the details of it now, but it's in the book, is I talk about this brilliant scientist, and he really was a brilliant scientist. He wasn't a charlatan. He just made a mistake. One of the brilliant things he did was isolate. He said, oh, this is the cell, this interstitial cell of the testes. That's the cell that secretes male hormone. Turned out he was right. We didn't name testosterone yet, but he did say that's the cell that releases male hormone. And we know that that is the cell. Now we know the one in the testes that releases testosterone. He was right about that. Here's where he went a little, took a left turn at the wrong, at the wrong stoplight. He also believed that, oh, if we could keep more male hormone in men, they'd be smarter. They'd be more aggressive. They'd have a longer urine stream. I'm not sure why that's considered manly. They'd have better libido, but it did count. They went.
This was back when everyone was peeing outside, marking their territory.
Exactly. Probably. And so he thought, oh, well, what would keep all this manly positive stuff in you? Oh, a vasectomy. So
no way. So this wasn't just a function of like, don't masturbate, don't waste seed, which has been a long standing, like, weird thing.
He was a pro. I mean, actually, I have to Google like Eugene Steinek masturbation to see what he thought about it. But he was kind of a pro sex kind of guy. I bet he was kind of pro masturbation, but I don't want to be quoted as saying that, you know, maybe his great grandchildren will be upset. But he was definitely a pro-vasectomy, claiming that vasectomies boosted libido.
Whoa.
And the wonderful thing about this story is it made sense for the time. So we can look back and be like, oh, you know, we can think that's wacky, but it did make sense for the time of what we know about science. And all of our theories are sort of based a little bit of conjecture. It's a lot of data and then conjecture. But 100% of the men that had vasectomies and were told this will make you think more clearly and this will boost your libido, 100% of them said it worked Freud got Steinacked. You know, we call it Steinacking, or we did, because that was the name of the scientist that promoted this theory. It became so popular, his name became a verb. Whoa. Freud was Steinacked. Yeats was Steinacked. Thousands of American men were lining up to have it done. Steinack himself did not do any of the operations. He just did animal research, but he told people how to do it. And so it really shows the power of suggestion, because there's no research to show that it didn't work. At the time, there were doctors saying, you know, I'm not so sure this makes sense. This is all based on testimonial, not scientific data.
Yeah.
And what were men saying? Oh, no, 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 but you're behind. You know, you doctors are stuck in your data. All my friends have had it done. Everyone says it's great. I think it proves that in the 1920s, sometimes we relied on testimonial, not scientific evidence. And it's so wonderful how we're not like that anymore.
I was about to say.
Right? I mean, look how far we've come. History does not repeat itself. Well, because nowadays, we would never, ever rely on testimonial. We would never read a book that has one person after another saying, even if your doctor says this is bullshit, do it anyhow, because all my friends say it works.
What doctors won't tell you.
Exactly.
What big pharma is keeping from you. But the funny thing is, virility, I guess, if you want to call it that, or I don't know, what are the words for like horniness? I don't know. Yeah. Those are in some ways measurable, in some ways kind of testable, but in other ways, highly subjective self-report things. And so you could easily convince yourself that you were hornier all the time if you wanted it to work.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's why it's so tricky, all these sex things that are out now. It's really hard. Like, we do know, for instance, that older women post-menopause, the vaginal lining thins. For some women, it can make sex really painful. It's almost like you're like, feel like sandpaper inside. It can be very uncomfortable. There are lubricants. We know estrogen works for that. Estrogen creams. There are other lubricants that work. So yeah, so that physical thing will help. But there's also issues with maybe sexual attraction to who your partner is. There's marital issues, perhaps. So it's sometimes, not all, but sometimes it's very hard to pinpoint, oh, this will cure you.
Yeah.
Because it's such a mix of things going on.
Well, and it's pretty unfortunate that, you know, I don't know how to put this delicately, because I think that this rises a lot of evolutionary psychology issues that are maybe not as evidence-based, but definitely some evolutionary biology issues, is that our sexual years, they're mismatched between men and women, right? Like, early on, they're sort of in sync, but men go through senescence way later than women go through menopause. And that could be, probably could cause some interpersonal conflict if you're mating for life, if you're matched with a partner and have every intention of staying with them through these processes.
Yeah, it does. And I know, you know, there are doctors now that specialize in menopause and sexuality, you know, after a certain age. And so sometimes it's not quite so out of sync, because men do sometimes have this low testosterone that can affect their sex drive.
But, or like, you know, heart problems. So they can't, you know, because erectile dysfunction isn't just testosterone, as you mentioned. It's, you know, you could have like blockages in your arteries that are
exactly
making it hard. Yeah.
But I do think.
Didn't mean that. Sorry.
No, yeah, yes. But I think what happens with women sometimes going through menopause is the end of your periods can mimic the beginning, meaning more PMS and heavier flows, and you're feeling like a teenager, except you're not talking about it and you don't realize. So sometimes that plays into libido, because you're just feeling bloated and annoyed at yourself for feeling bloated and thinking, I'm a big girl, I shouldn't be feeling this way. So sometimes that can also play into sexuality. And I also think just understanding your hormones and what's going on with your body, or realizing it's not me being stressed out that's making sex hurt.
Yeah.
It's actually vaginal thinning, and maybe a cream will help. You know, so all these things, we have to respect our hormones. And then we also have to realize, yeah, they're controlling us, but there are things we can do to be more compassionate to ourselves mm-hmm. and to also reach out and see, oh, is there anything that I can do that can make me feel better? In addition to, you know, just having a little more respect for myself and realizing responses can be slower, both in men and women as we age. Yeah. We're not like, you know, it's not like 18. We're like, oh, okay, now I feel like having sex. Now I'm going to get an orgasm in 2 seconds and everything's going to be wonderful. Things take a little longer. And, you know, I think the doctor's response would be, well, so what? You know,
like, yeah,
not a race. You know, it's not a race. So it doesn't matter. So what? It might take you a little longer to get aroused, but that's okay.
And also, like you said, you know, the more that you know about these things, the more that you know about your own endocrinology and your own biology, the more you're like, well, yeah, obviously that's what's happening.
Right. And also, the more you can be, hey, it's just my body. And you know what? I might be in my 50s and it might take me longer. But on the other hand, I'm also in my 50s and I'm not freaking out that like, oh my God, how do I look compared to like the girl he slept with last week? And this is, you know, we've been together now 30 years and this is what you're going to have to put up with.
But, yeah, I'm putting up with you. You're putting up with me.
Right. I think there are a lot of older women that are like, hey, this is my body and I can deal with it now. We don't have those freak out 20-year-old hoping to look like the model anymore.
Yeah. Well, and also like, menopause doesn't happen the way that, oh gosh, what's the word? There's a vocabulary word for this. Your first period. What is your first period called? Like menarche or something weird?
You like start that? Going through it. Yeah. Like yeah. In the early days. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So menopause is like slow. It like, or it's different for different people. Well, like my mother for years had like Costco level pregnancy tests in her bathroom because she always didn't know if this was like, did I not get my period or am I just not going to get my period? Like, am I pregnant at 60? And she also had really late menopause.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. It's slow and not slow. Like your hormones plummet. So that's kind of fast. Mm. But I think for most women, we tend to think menopause is something that happens to women 10 years older than we are. Like, what? I don't care if you're like 45 or 55. If you haven't gone through it, you kind of think, oh, I'm not going to go through it for another 10 years. That's just the way we live. Like, we just tend to think of ourselves as younger.
Oh, for sure. We're like, oh, that's an old people problem.
Exactly. And yeah. Like, old is 10 years older than whatever you are now.
Yeah.
So a lot of women start to feel menopausal, meaning kind of hot flashes, kind of uncomfortable, a little more panicky. They're feeling these hormonal changes in their 40s, some around mid 40s. Mm. We now call it perimenopause. There's a name for it. But we don't think of it as perimenopause. We just think we're going nuts, you know, because
because nobody in their 40s wants to feel. Yeah, because we're youth obsessed. And right. That actually is like, oh my gosh, this is my age. I am middle aged.
Exactly. And yeah, I mean, like I'm 56 and I consider myself middle age, and I guess I plan on living till I'm 120 or something. My kids were the ones who were like, Mom, you went through middle age like 15 years ago. And I was like, no, I think of myself more like in the 20, 30-year-old kind of category now.
Hell yeah.
but I guess other people would consider me in the older age range since I'm beyond the age of 55. But I think with menopause, a lot of women don't realize they're going through it. We just think we're going nuts. And we start thinking, because it's that time of life in your 40s, maybe your kids are going through puberty, or maybe you're busy juggling career and kids. So we tend not to think hormones. We tend to think, I can't hack it. What's wrong with me? Mm-hmm. And so that's when I think sometimes it's nice to realize, oh no, this is this perimenopausal time. This is what I'm going through. But it's just amazing. We really don't talk about it that much. I think women will talk about menopause once they're in the real thick of it, if they're dripping sweat and they could be like, oh, this is a hot flash. But they're not thinking of it, because sometimes hot flashes can actually make you kind of panicky, and they're not thinking that's related.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, there has been a stigma forever about, did you see that really great documentary, Period, End of Sentence? It won the, I think it won the Oscar.
Yeah.
For like the short form doc. It's really great. It's on Netflix. I recommend everybody check it out. It's really short. So it's a, you know, you don't have to dedicate too much time to sitting down in front of your computer or in front of your TV. But it's about, you know, a kind of cheap and easy way to make pads, basically sanitary napkins in India, where it's like still stigmatized to use a pad. Or I guess people can't really afford them. So it's more that, so being on your period is stigmatized in India, like, because they have to use cloth and it leaks. And lots of times girls don't even go to school during that period because they're like mortified.
And it's a combination. I mean, I haven't seen the documentary, but I know the story. Mm. And it's a lot of developing world rural areas that if you don't have pads, and the thought is, and it goes back to ancient times, the thought of like a menstruating woman should be separated from society. They're
like put newspaper under her or something, like put her out in the barn. Yeah.
I mean, there's still in some religions, like in very Orthodox Judaism, you're not supposed to like be near, like if you're husband and wife, I think you're supposed to have like some sort of barrier in the bed between you while the woman is menstruating.
Yeah, and there's some big bathing ritual after it's over too.
Yeah. So, and that goes back to this dirtiness. Like, but you know, the issue that's brought out in the documentary is that girls aren't going to school. That's a lot of school days missed if you're missing every time you menstruate during.
Yeah, that could be a fourth of your life.
Exactly.
I mean, man. Okay. I have to, I've kept you too long. I have 5 more minutes with you. I'm taking them too. And I have 3 things I want to cover in 5 minutes. So I think we can do it. Number one, it's going to have to be the short and sweet version, but can we take 2 seconds to talk about oxytocin, like what it is and how, I don't know, I have a frustration about how freaking overblown oxytocin has become in terms of charlatanism. And I mean, obviously oxytocin is a hormone, so it's strong. It has some real benefits, some real effects when it comes to attachment and parent infant things and even sexual things. But is it just me, or do you see like that oxytocin is everywhere and it's like the cure for everything lately?
Oh, it's my favorite hormone. I'm so glad you brought it up, because I share your frustration with all the complete craziness that's going on with this. So let's just first talk about what is oxytocin and what do we know? What's real? What's the real news? Oxytocin is the hormone that squeezes your uterus to get the baby out.
Okay.
It's also the hormone that gets your milk flowing when you went to nurse your baby. We also now know, and there's some wonderful, real research going on looking at oxytocin receptors in the brain. Mm-hmm. We think that oxytocin, from studies of goats and rodents, has something to do with mother-baby bonding. Mm-hmm. We know that oxytocin spikes at birth to get the baby out. And we know from studies, if we block oxytocin in rats, we're not going to do this in humans. If we block it in the brain of rats or in goats right after they give birth, those new mom goats will headbutt their babies.
Oh my gosh.
I know, it's so sad. Not so sad, a little happier. We know that if we inject into the brain, if we inject oxytocin into the brain of virgin rats, they will start cuddling newborn babies and try to nurse them. And typically rats are awful babysitters. They hate baby rats that are not their own. They will maul them. They will destroy them. They will kill them. Give them oxytocin. They will like shove their little tiny nothing nipple into that baby's. Now, we know that extrapolating that to humans is a far leap. We know that people who adopt babies really love them. You know, we don't know about their oxytocin surge. Maybe they have them, but we know that you can love a baby without having your womb squeezed to get it out. So that's all what we know about oxytocin. Mm-hmm. We do think oxytocin has something to do with social skills. But so far in the studies, giving oxytocin to autistic children, it's been tried, has not really helped.
Yeah.
What I think bothers you and really pisses me off, this drives me crazy, is that you can go online. Again, do not do this now. Please listen to us. You can go online and for $48, buy an oxytocin spray. And it's guaranteed to make, like, if you spray it around you, the guy next to you or the girl next to you, or whoever you want to hook up with, it's going to make them be attracted to you.
Oh, it's the new Spanish fly.
Yeah, exactly. But it could be water. Who knows what's in it? And there's all sorts of oxytocin candies and oxytocin this, and it's going to make you bond, because if mother rats bond with baby rats, then why wouldn't it make some guy on the street bond with you? So this is just the typical way that we take a really true seed of science and we just extrapolate it way too far and try to make money from it.
Yep, yep. We call that pseudoscience. We call that taking advantage of people who are desperate and taking all of their money. So frustrating. So I'm so glad that you share the same frustrations as I do. Okay, second of the three things. We have to, I'm not going to let you get out of this interview without talking about your history, because it's so fascinating to me that, okay, you've written two incredible books. And I apologize, have you written more than that? I'm only aware of the two.
No.
So your first one was about pregnancy.
Yeah, first one's Get Me Out, A History of Childbirth from the Garden of Eden to the Sperm Bank.
I love
it. Then the second one, Aroused, The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything.
And of course, you have lots of letters after your name. And I think sometimes letters confuse people because they don't know what they stand for. Most people know what MD means. That means you went to medical school. Mm-hmm. But long before you went to medical school, you studied some really interesting things. So what did you study for your undergrad?
Yeah, so it's funny. It all sounds like my fake way of presenting myself as if, like, when I was 17, I had this path and I knew exactly what I was going to do with my life. And I can kind of fake it and speak that way. But I was really confused. And I was just sort of like wanted to do liberal arts, but I liked science. I liked writing. I was a history and sociology of science major. So like history of medicine.
Very cool.
In the long run, works so well with the books I've written. But to be honest, I chose that major because I was an utterly confused undergrad and was like, I like science, I like history, I like English. Oh, this major is kind of a non-major, kind of like just anything. And I can check off the box, what, you know, second semester, sophomore year, and I fulfilled a major. So I did major in that, and which worked out well because now that's what I write about. So I can say, oh, like I had this plan when I was 7.
I knew it all along.
I knew exactly the direction my life was going to go in. After college, I was toying with the idea of whether I wanted to write about medicine or go to medical school. And I got into Columbia Journalism School. So I went there and I studied journalism for a year. And it was great for me because I really hadn't done much journalism undergrad. So it was a huge learning curve. I think I was probably the stupidest person in my entire class at Columbia because I was so confused. Like a lot of people were editors of their school newspaper and just knew the jargon, and I just didn't know the jargon.
But you knew about the stuff you were writing about, which is helpful.
Yeah, I did that. But I took, you know, we had to take like police reporting and other stuff. So there was stuff that I didn't know what I was writing about either. But
so
I
you did a full degree in that. You did a master's. It wasn't like a certificate program or.
Yeah. No, I did a master's. It was a 1-year program. And then I did go to medical school after that. I did not do an internship or residency. And then, yeah, I just never can get away from school. And while I was working on my first book, I thought, oh, I should take some more history classes. And I started dabbling in history of public health. And I was living in New York City then and was taking courses at Columbia. So I ended up getting a master's in public health at Columbia. And it was good because part of the master's is taking epidemiology and biostatistics, which I feel like I should do every few years, take a refresher course just for the point of data analytics. I think it's an interesting thing as a writer to refresh yourself on how to analyze studies. So that's my background. And now I've never practiced medicine, but I teach medical writing. So my students are like my patients. They're just healthier. And I write and I support. So
I love that. And so are you, do you teach at, because you went to Columbia for both your master's and for your MPH, but you got your medical degree at Yale. Where do you live now?
I live in New York City, but I teach at both Columbia and Yale. So I take the train to New Haven. I get a lot of work done on the train. The train is like my office. So I commute back and forth to Yale. And I teach undergrads there. And I'm also the writer in residence at the medical school. So I work with medical students and residents who are interested in writing, and we get together and talk about writing, and I edit their things. So I'm at Yale a lot, and I also have students at Columbia Journalism School.
That's fascinating and so great that there is the opportunity for medical students, you know, which I think is actually quite progressive, that there is an acceptance and an understanding of how important it is to learn how to write. You know, we're just starting to see that change in most of the like life and physical sciences departments, where science communication is something that is actually, you know, enjoyed and promoted instead of like heavily frowned upon. And so I think it's really cool to hear that there's a place for that kind of work at Yale. I mean, obviously, yeah, in the journalism school at Columbia, it makes sense. But at Yale, that's cool.
Yeah, I love that. There's a woman, Dr. Anna Reisman, and she runs the program for humanities and medicine at Yale. And it's a really robust program. And I think, yeah, for those who want to write and hone their skills, we do that. But I also think so many people that go to medical school, like I think 100% of people that go to medical school have other interests too. Mm-hmm. You know, there's few people that are just like, this is all I want to do is memorize this stuff. So I feel in addition to science communication, it's also a wonderful outlet to make medical students and residents and doctors still feel like they're humans that have interests in music and literature and the arts. And it's interesting to see how this plays into doctor-patient communication and issues that they've had on the wards, because it's life, you know. It's so I'm proud that we do that there at Yale and make a nice home for the students that are interested.
It's so cool. And of course, it's one of my favorite styles of writing. If you were to look at my bookshelf, which is loaded with science communication, I think the books that resonate with me the absolute most are the sort of physician memoirs about things like death and dying, about things like patient advocacy. Like those are the things that stand out to me so much. And I could just rattle off all of my favorite books, but I won't right now because I want to close the show with you. And I want to do it by asking you my final two questions that I ask everybody who comes on the show. And they're kind of big picture. Are you ready for that?
I will be. I have to be, I guess, right?
So
I have no choice.
I want you to think about the future, and I want you to think about it in whatever context is relevant to you right now. It could be the future of your personal life. It could be like an existential future, a global future, whatever is, you know, relevant and first comes to mind. And number one, I want you to tell us, you know, what is the thing that is most disconcerting to you? Maybe the thing that keeps you up the most at night, that you're pessimistic, even potentially kind of cynical about. But on the flip side of that, what are you genuinely, like honestly, not lip service, optimistic and hopeful for?
I think it's the same thing, actually.
Love
so
it.
What seriously keeps me up at night, actually what keeps my husband up at night, because it pisses me off so much, I actually like will say, oh my God, this is really annoys me. So I keep him up at night talking about it. What keeps me up at night is fake news about science, is the anti-vaccine stuff, the people who are peddling things that they know they should not be peddling. And what really irks me is that some of the really super smart people that know exactly what they're doing, you know, selling these oxytocin sprays or telling you, come to me and I'm going to put you on a hormone balancing diet for only $10,000 a month or whatever. I think that there's people out there that are smart enough to know that there's a market in the wealthy, worried well. Mm-hmm. And if you can tap into that wealthy, worried well market, you can just spew all sorts of shit of go on this dairy-free, gluten-free, take this hormone, try this cream, take my cream that's the same as your pharmacy, but I put a fancy label on it. And I spend a lot of time, you know, one of my good friends actually just emailed me about something he was going to do, and he's a good friend. So I was able to say with the most wonderful bedside manner, "Are you fucking crazy? Good. Waste your money doing that." I tend not to say that unless I've known, unless you're on my freshman hall in college, then I'll say that to you. But other than that, I tend to be like, well, maybe that's not what you need to be doing. So that's what keeps me up at night. And I think what's really disturbing now is the way that people can use social media in ways that I think those of us who care about science communication, we need to be using social media in a way to promote good science and have people not roll their eyes to, no, you need a vaccine. Don't roll your eyes to that and then get, then seek out the anti-vaccine, or you don't need this medicine that you really do need. So that's what keeps me up at night. And that's what infuriates me to no end. Like, I collect these articles and I did this yesterday. I started like finding stuff online and like sending it to other, what I thought, like-minded people. And even if you're like-minded with me, you probably don't want the bombardment of my emails all the time. Can you believe that she's doing this? Do you know this person? Do you know anything about her? So that drives me crazy. On an optimistic note, I work with medical students now. I work with pre-meds. I work with some really wonderful people that I do believe are going to be the leaders in the next generation. And I think that we're teaching students, not just at Yale, but I really do think all over there's this push for real doctor-patient communication. It sounds so trite, but I do think that some of the issues people have now is they'll say to me, "I didn't have time. My doctor had no time for me, but this alternative healer really sat down with me for an hour the way no other doctor has." And so I think, I realize doctors are crunched for time, but sometimes it doesn't take that long to have compassion and to reach out and hold a hand. I'm truly optimistic that the people now that are undergrads and want to go into medicine, they can't help but know you don't go into medicine to make a lot of money. They're reading what's going on in medicine. They're reading what's going on in healthcare. And the students that I know that are going into medicine, they're not doing it to become famous, and they're not doing it because they think they're going to make a ton of money. They're doing it because they really care about doctor-patient relationships, and they do it because they want to make a difference in people's lives. And so maybe I'm being really naive, but I'm very optimistic that we're going to have some wonderful leaders in medicine that will pave a way, that will help provide a much better route for patients to know like what the truth is and to feel that they can have a trusting relationship with their healthcare providers.
Gosh, I hope so. I mean, I obviously, as somebody who's studying clinical psychology now, I agree wholeheartedly. I don't get to see it on the front lines, but you're there. You're at Yale and you're lecturing and you're meeting a lot of these young medical students. And so hopefully you are seeing a change in, I think, in the way that students are being trained, in a way that they are being supervised, and hopefully all of those things will lead to it. Because I think when students first come out of undergrad and or graduate school and they start their medical degrees, that's what they want. And it's like browbeaten out of them. And absolutely, so hopefully there is a change there.
Absolutely. And I'm hoping there will be a change. And I'm hoping that we're keeping an eye on the mental health, not just of the patients, but of the young physicians themselves. I think we need to do that. I think we have to think about the mental health of doctors and worry about burnout and keep them energized and caring.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, gosh, Randy, this was such a fascinating, fascinating chat. Everybody, the book is Aroused, The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything. If people want to keep up with your work, if they want to find you maybe in social media, are you active there? Like, where can they follow your work?
I'm pretty active. I have a website, randyhutterepstein.com, so they can find out all about me there. I mean, not all about me. It's the me that I will portray to the public. The goofy, silly me is like in my house, but I don't invite everyone in the world, you know, to come over. But you can go to my website. And yes, I'm on Twitter at Randy H. Epstein. And yeah, and you, so you can find me. And I have an author page on Facebook, also Randy Hutter Epstein. But probably the website's the best way.
Awesome. Well, once again, Randy, thank you so, so very much. It really was a blast.
Thanks. I had so much fun. I'm so appreciative that you invited me.
Oh, absolutely. And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.